During my time at college, that's when I met Sally. Brilliant, determined, full of energy, and a wicked sense of humor. She was working at a bank while studying business and banking, juggling both with an ease that made it all look effortless. I remember the first day of class like it was yesterday. She walked in late, her hair a blazing, almost fluorescent orange bob that lit up the room. Heads turned. Nobody said a word. We were all too polite or too stunned, maybe both. She scanned the room and made a beeline for the empty seat next to me. The moment she sat down, I couldn't help myself. I blurted out, "What the fuck have you done to your hair?" She burst out laughing. "I fucked it up," she said without missing a beat. "I bought some homemade bleach to go blonde, and clearly I overdid it. Now I've got to walk around like this till it grows out." I grinned. Well, Sally could see the humor in even the worst situations, and she never minded laughing at herself. "At least you've got nice eyes, and you could always wear a hat." She laughed again. That was it. We clicked. Straight away, I thought we'd hit it off. That lunchtime, I offered to take her out for a drink. We went to the Swan and Mitre pub at the end of the high street. Campari and bitter lemon, it stuck in my mind, even after all these years. The conversation flowed as easily as the drinks. But after a while, she excused herself to use the loo. Minutes passed, then more. 10, 15, 20. She didn't return. Thinking she'd done a runner, I downed the last of my drink and drove back to college. When I rejoined the class, she wasn't there either. I assumed she must have gone home. She'd mentioned earlier she was living with her dad in Hayes Lane. An hour later, she stormed into the room, face like thunder. She sat next to me without a word, muttered an apology to the teacher for being late, and proceeded to give me the full silent treatment. I was baffled. Eventually, I leaned over and said, "I waited 20 minutes for you. You didn't show. I thought you'd legged it." She turned her head and hissed, "My day's been a nightmare. First, my hair this morning. Then in the pub, I went to the toilet and the bloody lock jammed. I was stuck. No one came in for ages. I was banging, shouting, crying out. Eventually, someone heard me and got the staff. They had to break the door open to let me out. And when I finally got out, you were gone. I had to get a bus back here." I couldn't help it. I burst out laughing. So did she. That was Sally. She could see the humor in even the worst situations. We complemented each other perfectly. She possessed a deep passion for cooking and had dreams of one day opening her very own delicatessen. While I found myself increasingly drawn to the vibrant energy of wine bars and cozy cafes, our shared interests and aspirations brought us closer together, making our college experience unforgettable. But there was a wall between us that love alone couldn't break. My parents couldn't accept it. They didn't want me in love with an English girl, a Christian. They made that painfully clear. They pressured me, lectured me, pleaded with me. I was torn in half. I loved my parents, but I loved Sally too. Why couldn't they see that? Why couldn't they just let me have this one thing, this one happiness? In the end, under that relentless pressure, I cracked. Sally and I broke up. It felt like someone had ripped the heart out of my chest and left me there to bleed. I was lost, numb. My parents even tried to sweeten the poison, offering to arrange a marriage for me with a proper girl. They dangled promises of a car, a house, a perfect life. But what use was any of it if I couldn't have her? Sally was gone, or so it should have been, because I couldn't let go. I couldn't stop thinking about her, the way she laughed, the way she'd look at me like I was the only man in the world. One afternoon, unable to bear it any longer, I made a decision that would haunt me. I left my dad's clothes factory in Whitechapel just after the 4:00 tea break and drove into the heart of London, the city roaring and indifferent around me, and parked opposite her office. I waited. The minutes dragged. My heart pounded. A little after 5, the doors swung open, and there she was. But she wasn't alone. She was holding someone's hand, another man. They were smiling, talking. She didn't even see me. My vision tunneled. My hands shook on the steering wheel. I got out of the car without thinking. My legs felt like lead. I followed them at a distance, the city blurring around me, nothing making sense except the way their hands were clasped together. When they paused at a pedestrian crossing, I lost it. I charged forward. I grabbed him, spun him around, and punched him square in the face. He went down hard. Sally's scream cut through the noise of London traffic like a blade. Time seemed to freeze. I remember looking at her face, searching, desperate for something. Shock, guilt, regret, anything that meant she still felt something for me. But there was only horror. And then it all collapsed. The adrenaline drained away, leaving my body hollow and cold. What had I done? I turned and ran. Shame burned through me with every pounding step as I ran. I didn't feel victorious. I didn't feel avenged. I felt like a thug, a monster. Even if she'd cared for me once, how could she ever forgive me now? But even then, even after all of that, I still couldn't let her go. I was desperate, consumed. One evening I convinced her to let me come over to her flat. I needed to see her face, to plead my case in person. I thought I could win her back with some grand declaration of love. When she hesitated, I went too far. Told her that if she didn't take me back, I'd jump from her bedroom window. Sally didn't scream or beg. She called my bluff, her voice calm, eyes steady. But I was too far gone to stop. I climbed out onto the ledge, expecting her to pull me in, to tell me she couldn't bear to lose me. Instead, I found myself dangling, legs flailing, arms trembling, real fear tightening in my chest. And then I fell. It wasn't a dramatic plunge from a high rise, but it was enough. The bushes below broke my fall, scratching me to ribbons but sparing me real injury. I scrambled out, humiliated, brushing leaves off my clothes, avoiding the stares of passers-by. I didn't even say goodbye. I just hurried home in the dark, shaking with shame, convinced I'd destroyed whatever was left between us. But the next day, my phone rang. It was Sally. Her voice cracked when she asked if I was okay. She'd spent the night replaying it over and over, realizing that my reckless desperation wasn't some trick. It was raw, ugly proof of how much I loved her. That call changed everything. She let me back in. And once she did, neither of us wanted to let go again. Sally packed up her life, moved out of the flat she shared with Debbie, and we moved in together, into a bedsit at 72 Beulah Hill, Norwood. A stone's throw from Crystal Palace, perched on the edge of South London, it was an enormous Victorian house, weathered and weary, standing defiantly behind scaffolding like an old prize fighter refusing to quit. When we went to view it, it looked like a building site. A giant skip squatted on the driveway. A disused minibus with flat tires leaned against the curb like a drunk after last orders. The front door was wide open. Inside, the air smelled of sawdust and damp plaster. Barry, the landlord, greeted us at the threshold, a tall man with mousy hair and a mustache, charming in a way that made you instantly trust him. "This way," he said, leading us through the main hall. Bare floorboards stretched out, some ripped clean, others missing altogether, exposing joists and pipes like bones under skin. Tools lay abandoned in corners. It looked chaotic, until we turned toward the staircase. That's when things changed. The stairs were covered in brand new Berber carpet, pale and plush. Halfway up where the staircase turned, a small landing stood like a stage, and on it, perched with quiet elegance, a single pot stand with a crimson rose. One touch of beauty in the mess. One promise of what could be. Barry led us up. The fresh carpet rolled out across the landing and onto the first floor, still shedding soft fluff along the skirting boards. Three bedrooms up there. A narrow galley kitchen. A shared bathroom. And then, our room. He opened the door and it took our breath away. A huge space flooded with light from a bay window. Inside, a double bed with a brand new mattress, a two-seater sofa tucked into the corner, a small dining table perfectly placed in the bay, a towering chest of drawers, long green curtains sweeping down to the floor like velvet rivers. For £400 a month plus £400 deposit, it was ours. Today, if we wanted it, we didn't hesitate. Barry ran through the roster of housemates like a host introducing dinner guests. Next door, Diana, Australian photographer. Across the hall, Alex, Scottish lad. Musicians upstairs, Jeff and Mary. He's on tour most of the time. Mary sings a cappella and teaches saxophone. We were sold. There was even room on the driveway for our market van and my Toyota Celica. Barry agreed without blinking. The months that followed were some of the happiest of my life. We settled into a rhythm. I'd drive Sally to work most mornings, drop her at the bank, then head to Whitechapel to the factory. Some days she'd make her own way home while I crisscrossed London, delivering fabric to outworkers or ferrying finished garments back to clients. Saturdays and Sundays were ours, market days, shoulder to shoulder, working side by side. The house itself was a world of its own, a little bohemian kingdom. We drifted between rooms, drinking wine with Diana, laughing until midnight. Jeff and Mary would wander down, saxophone cases in hand. Some nights, Sally cooked for all of us, curry bubbling in one pot, pasta swirling in another. We had garden parties that stretched into the early hours, bonfire nights under a sky salted with stars, and Wimbledon afternoons on the lawn with strawberries and cream. We were young, in love, and for a while, life was nothing but light. Then came the rash. It appeared out of nowhere, angry red patches crawling across my skin. I went to the doctor, who prescribed a lotion that needed to be painted over every inch of me, including the private parts. Humiliating? Maybe. But Sally didn't flinch. "Lie down," she said, cool as ice. I stretched out on the bed, sheets pulled taut beneath me. She started with my back, her fingers firm, the lotion cool against my burning skin. Then she told me to turn over. The air in the room felt sharp and clean as she worked methodically, her touch both clinical and tender. I lay there, half wishing the rash would never clear. A few days later, the sheets were ruined, but the redness was gone. The irritation vanished. We laughed about it, the way we laughed about everything back then. Not long after, I woke up one market day, doubled over with stomach pain. Agony. It hit me like a punch, the kind of pain that steals your breath. I walked into the local GP's surgery, back in the days when you could just stroll in, and minutes later I was on my way to Mayday Hospital. Suspected appendicitis. They admitted me immediately, ready to cut me open. By then, I'd already taught Sally to drive in my car. I handed her the keys and told her to head home. That night, though, the pain vanished. Gone, like it had never been there. I told the nurses I felt fine, probably just gas, but they wouldn't let me go. "The doctor will decide Monday," they said. "Until then, you're not leaving." So I stayed, made myself useful. Ran little errands for the bedbound blokes in the ward. The next day, Sally turned up, eyes wide, voice shaking. On her way to see me, she'd taken a bend too fast, and a lamppost leapt out from nowhere and wrapped itself around the car. The Celica's front end looked like an accordion, completely undrivable. We arranged for a tow and a local garage, but I only cared about one thing. "You're okay?" I asked her. "That's all that matters. It's just a car." When I got back to the ward, the matron tore into me for leaving. "This is a hospital, not a hotel," she barked. I couldn't resist. If it were a hotel, I'd expect better service. She wasn't amused. I promised to behave, at least until Monday. Life carried on at Beulah Hill. Evenings curled up in bed, the soft sound of Mary's saxophone drifting through the ceiling as she played her haunting version of Paul McCartney's Take It Away. Barry, our easygoing landlord, became part of the story too. A squash fanatic. We'd play for hours, sweating, laughing, pushing each other until the lights flickered out on the court. Our love didn't just survive, it thrived. Weekends found us shoulder to shoulder at market stalls, selling clothes from my parents' factory. Young, ambitious, determined to carve out a life that was ours. I can still see her now, sleeves rolled up, wind teasing her hair, laughter spilling over as she charmed every customer who stopped by. One day, making a delivery in Croydon, I parked outside the registry office and couldn't shake the thought, what if Sally and I got married right here? By then, we'd bought the Orpington house. I pictured carrying her across that threshold, her laughter echoing through empty rooms. There was this boutique in Camden called Scott's she loved. She'd been dreaming of a peach two-piece outfit there, all frills and lace. That same day, I made up my mind. I booked the registry office for August 13, 1983, reserved the dress, and that night, with my heart pounding, I asked her to marry me. She just smiled and said yes. She didn't care about the short notice, didn't care about traditions or big white weddings. All she wanted was us. Eventually the day came, we packed our things and left. To build a life brick by brick, a future that began in that ramshackle Victorian house. When we left, it was bittersweet. That place had been more than a home. It was a chapter. Wild, messy, beautiful. Every single housemate came to our wedding. Our wedding was small, intimate. My mother refused to come, her disapproval as silent and heavy as a locked door. But my father pulled me aside quietly, squeezed my shoulder, and told me to follow my heart. It was bittersweet. But we wouldn't let that spoil it. We gathered our closest friends, our family, my Uncle Asen and his family, and in true Jamil fashion, it didn't all go smoothly. After the ceremony, we all piled back to our new house for the reception, only to realize we'd left the keys inside and locked ourselves out. It was my younger brother Airman who saved the day. He borrowed a ladder from the neighbors, scrambled up to the bathroom window, which, mercifully, was ajar, and climbed in to let us all through. It wasn't glamorous. It wasn't polished, but it was ours, and it was perfect.